CESAR is worth the Joint Global Change Research Institute. The Joint Global Change Research Institute is a joint collaboration between Pacific Northwest National Lab and University of Maryland. He's also with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC.
Thank you. Thank you, Tris. Good morning. I'd like to first acknowledge my co-authors. As you can see, a number of them. We are from different institutions, but we all collaborate in this multidisciplinary project called the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. I'd like to describe my objectives for today. First, I'd like to provide a brief description of the DOE GLBSC project. I'd like to discuss, following up with Tris' discussion on special explicit methods to model biofuel production and environmental impacts at the regional scale, and then provide some insights on the identification and calculation of marginal lands available for biofuel crop production. But first, as you know, land use change, land management has become a central topic for everything that has to do with climate change. And I think we have to acknowledge that. And as an example, I show this slide from taken from a publication by Fargioni et al. That appeared last year in Science, talking about that if we do it wrong, I think biofuels may have bad consequences on emissions and on land as well, land quality. And you can see that the carbon debt that we can incur by deforesting parts of the tropical forest or farming peatlands or so on can have devastating consequences in terms of the carbon emissions. And I'd like to accompany that by a recent publication in Science by some of my collaborators at the Joint Global Change Research Institute, Weiss et al., showing the impacts that these not valuing terrestrial carbon may have on emissions. And you see three graphs. The one on the left is for scenario of land use evolution during the 21st century as affected by no policy in this case. So basically you see the evolution of assuming changes in productivity and so on. So you see the distribution of land use over time. And the role that bio in this small wedge, I'm sorry, how do you go back? You can see here the role of bioenergy crops, that wedge, how it's entering late in the into the 21st century. The graph on the right is when you impose a charge on the number B is when you impose tax on carbon emissions, but not only from fossil fuels and industrial emissions, but also from land use emissions. If you consider that, you know, you value the carbon, you can see that, you know, eventually there's even a sort of a decrease, demand for land by crops, and energy is small as well. But if you don't value carbon on land, and only tax fossil fuel and industrial emissions, that may have a devastating effect on displacing crop production by bioenergy crops, and then eventually that can move into the and managed land and forest land. So that will create a tremendous impact on land and land use emissions. The DOE Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is one of the three bioenergy centers started to be funded back in 2007 by DOE. It's a private research partnership led by University of Wisconsin-Madison and Michigan State University. The mission that we have there is to try to accelerate the deployment of bioenergy pipeline, but also to do it in a way that is economically and environmentally sustainable. And it has five thrusts. The first one is on production, how to create innovative methods for enhancing the production of plant biomass. The second one is on the processing of the biomass. The third one is on the conversion. And the fourth thrust is on the sustainable practices. And this is where we stand. I'm going to concentrate now on this thrust. In the sustainability thrust led by Phil Robertson at Michigan State, we have six components: novel production systems, improved microbial plant interactions, biogeochemical responses, biodiversity responses, socioeconomic responses, and modeling. And in the field, both at the Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan and at Arlington in Wisconsin, we have deployed field plots, large plots, to study how different systems of different input rates and diversity respond to as they are grown for biomass production. So we go from high input systems and low diversity, such as continuous corn, all the way to low input systems with high diversity, such as the prairie systems. So all these treatments are arranged, going from a range of different rotations, switchgrass, miscanthus, and poplars, and so on. And we use those field laboratories to try to understand these plant microbe interactions, to try to understand the water balance, the biogeochemical responses, carbon cycle, trace gas emissions, trying to understand issues of biodiversity, not only on these plots, but also on larger plots. And then the modeling, both the economic modeling and the biophysical modeling. And talking about modeling, this is kind of how we conceive the modeling framework to proceed. We have different scales of resolution from the site all the way to the globe. And then we use different modeling tools on the left side from, say, biophysical models such as EPIC, watershed models, EPICS and SWAT, economic models, life cycle analysis, and integrated assessment models. So all these set of models are talking to each other and transferring information at different scales of resolution. Now I'm going to just to concentrate on the first part on the using the EPIC model for site and regional scales. Brief introduction about the EPIC model. It's a comprehensive biophysical and biogeochemical model that's been designed and improved just to be able to understand production processes affected by climate, soil, and management interactions. We have added a few things about the EPIC model in terms of the carbon cycle and connected to erosion, and also trace gases, and also carbon emission coefficients as well. The what we call the GLBRC methodology. So we use the biophysical model EPIC. Then we use the spatial explicit data that's similar to what Trace was mentioning. We use weather information either from DayMet or from NAR, the North American reanalysis project. We also use land cover information from USDA, this so-called crop data layers, a 56 meter resolution, soils from Sergo at different scales, and land capability. That's something that we thought it would be really useful to understand the question of marginal lands. We have a variety of land use and management treatments, try to understand the economic implications of different types of biofuels. And we also have the other component, the scaling, trying to go from plots information to regional scale, we call the REMAS, or regional intensive modeling areas, in Michigan and Wisconsin, and then to try to scale up to the 10-state region that's called the North Central region. A view of the GLBRC plots at KBS, overlaid over the Sergo map, you can see that basically on Kalamazoo soil, and you know, in principle, it appears that it's quite uniform. But if you visit the plot, you'll see that there's some variability in there. So scientists are trying to understand that variability. Now, a bit of a reminder for some of you about the use of land capability information to delineate the modeling units. We have land capabilities, which is an interpreted classification derived from soil maps such as Stasco and Sergo. And the land classes are based on use limitation, for example, soil depth of erosion risk, slope, etc. And we know that we have eight land capability classes from 1 to 8. Class 1 is the prime one, the best land. Class 8 is the one that cannot be used for anything but wildlife. And in between, you have classes of various limitations. 1 through 4 is considered to be arable land, and 5 to 7 is considered to be non-arable. So that's going to help us to understand, you know, these regional intensive modeling areas. And here you see the crop data layer for one of the Michigan REMA, which is a nine-county area centered on Kalamazoo County here. And the city of Kalamazoo, the yellow colors are for corn in 2007. The green is for soybean. Then you have fuchsia for barley, and pink for alfalfa, and so on. So you have the crop distribution. Now, if you overlay, if you simplify the classification into field crops, herbaceous vegetation, and woody vegetation, you can see the patterns of production in there. The field crops in yellow, in green, you have the herbaceous vegetation, pastures, and so on. And then in brown, you have the woody vegetation. And then you have some other classifications such as vegetable crops, orchards, wetlands, open water, developed land, and barren land. And if you plot on top, overlay the land capabilities, you see that basically how there's a very good coincidence of that farmers are using basically the best land for producing the crops. These colors 1 through 4 are, this is all the best land here that is being cropped. And this is land of less quality here. And you can see some of the limitations that you have in terms of the erosion limitations or wetness limitations or climatic limitation and so on. Climatic limitation is not very much present here, but you have some the type of limitation that is might be affecting the production here. Just to give you a brief information about the simulation scenarios and the output that we obtained. We simulated about 54 scenarios for the economic and environmental analysis using annual and perennial crop situations, continuous or in rotation, different input levels, different tillage levels, with or without residue removal. In total of about 70,000 simulations we did for this exercise. I'm not going to be able to present the results except just one example. But in the model output, we obtain information on plant yield for grain, for seed yield, for residue yield, and biomass yield. Then we also assess soil erosion, the water balance, the carbon balance, including eroded carbon, nitrogen losses, including leaching and nitrous oxide emissions. Just to give you a bit of an example of the type of spatial explicit simulation that we're able to do for the Michigan REMA. On the left side, you see the corn yields, spatial explicit corn yields, different colors, but also you see small speckles of different colors indicating the high degree of specificity that we can get with these type of simulations. So we can get very, very good detail trying to understand the issue of production, land use change, and marginal lands for biomass production. And on the right side, you see a difference map. So you see the corn yields when you remove corn residues, crop residues. In this case, it's versus, the comparison is no removal versus removal. And interestingly enough, and for us, I think it was sort of a counterintuitive, but in these simulations, which are not too long, they're about 24-year simulations, we see that actually by removing the residue, you see a small increase in crop yields. We're still studying that, and we believe that may be related to the fact of the natural mineralization that we have in the system. But if you do the other map about the soil erosion, so you see the soil erosion rates on the left side for the conventional tilled corn without crop residue removal. But when you start you can see the right map, the map on the right showing the difference in soil erosion, you can see that crop residue removal does affect soil erosion rate by increasing these rates. Now let me go into the expansion of this methodology to the 10 state regions, going from North Dakota down to Nebraska, east to Ohio, and up to Michigan. You see the crop data layer for the 10 states. There's a lot of information there. You know, you see the crops, you see the herbaceous vegetation and so on, and then we just do the reclassification, and we can see the entire region classified into fewer classes, with field crops in yellow, herbaceous vegetation in green, and woody vegetation in brown, and then water and so on. And what we did here was to do an analysis of pixel by pixel to try to understand the different land use categories and the land capability. So we have now a matrix in which we can evaluate the different distribution of land use by different classes. So we can do this grouping, and we can start thinking about the possibility of different scenarios for biomass crop production. In yellow, for example, if you were to only use those lands, here, for example, field crops with class 4, you can dedicate that for marginal crop production, and you can grow biofuel crops, perennial biofuel crops, or use, for example, classes 5 to 7 in the light orange, or, for example, herbaceous vegetation here, classes 1 to 3 and 4 and so on. So you can have the minimum and maximum scenarios of biofuel production. And just to illustrate these, here you see a scenario of how much land will be available for biofuel production under minimal conditions. So we have excluded the area of public lands in pink. So we have areas of in green that will represent the minimum scenario for biofuel production. And then we can overlay a different map if we were to include other lands for biofuel production. This is the level of detail that we have in these maps is about up to 500 meter resolution. So we can get an idea of what type of land will be available for biofuel production and make the right selection for the further examining the potential of these lands for meeting the requirements for biofuel production that we have in legislation, for example. So in summary, just let me give you an idea that in order to address some of these issues, I think we need to have interdisciplinary teams working together towards the development of a sustainable bioenergy economy. And by the examples that I provided, this spatial explicit methodology appears to be useful for modeling the production scenarios, not only from the point of view of the production, but also the environmental impacts at different scales. And finally, I think I just show you just that methodology, how we can apply that methodology for the calculation of marginal lands that might be available for biofuel crop production. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Cesar. There's a couple of things that stand out in that presentation. I'm only going to mention two, which is that the land capability class that you've used clearly seems to be at least a first way to focus the available land to the lands that we actually want to grow the crops on. And the second, in doing so, Nebraska is apparently a gold mine for biomass. Are there any questions? We have time for maybe one.
Yeah, if you go back to the slide that you just showed of marginal land, the large green area in Nebraska, that's the Nebraska sandhills, and that is very, the sand is 90% pure sand, and that is totally unsuitable for biomass production. Mm-hmm. So your model is not working.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. But we let that system be driven by the data. And it may be the case that, you know, we have to further go into that, into those types of land and see what kinds of things can be grown in there, or maybe nothing. And that's something that we need to understand.
You're going to have to rangeland because it's in permanent vegetation, but yeah. Once you start harvesting it, you're going to have tremendous erosion.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that this is all mostly driven by data, so by the crop data information, by the soil properties and the land capabilities. And it may be that, for example, we may have to exclude land that may appear to be good in principle, that but the slope situation may indicate that it's not possible to do that. So
the data is there, especially with soil texture.
But you're using digital data sets that you're accessing online.
Yeah.
So it raises the question, the next step would really be more calibration validation. How would you validate, or what approach to validation would be used?
I think we have to go into data sets such as, for example, the one that Chris was talking about, these field data sets, and make sure that we, both from simulation and from field observations, we have the validation of these methodology.
Last question.
Yeah, you're basically going to need to do some ground truth.
Exactly. Yeah.
Next speaker, Atul Jain from University of Illinois. Atul, you're with the